From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson is away today. On today's program, leaders of the world's 20 largest economies reach agreement on a plan to boost global gross domestic product by more than $2 trillion over 5 years. A female member of Afghanistan's parliament survives a suicide bombing. Michael Lippin will be here to explore the meeting described by many as icy between the leaders of China and Japan. Investors look ahead to the launch of the Hong Kong Shanghai Stock Connect program, and that begins later today. In the American Cafe, how future journalists must differ from their predecessors, and a look at a new film about Muhammad Ali. All of that and more on VOA Global from the Voice of America. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asia news and events for Monday, November 17th. I'm Ira Melman in for Jim Stevenson today. Pakistan's military says fresh fighting in a volatile northwestern border region has left at least 34 militants and 3 soldiers dead. Fighter planes bombed suspected hideouts Sunday morning in the Dakhel area of North Waziristan Agency, a semi-autonomous tribal territory near the Afghan border. The Army's media wing says at least 27 militants, including important commanders and foreigners, were killed in the action. These airstrikes follow overnight clashes in Dakhel that left 3 soldiers and 7 militants dead. Officials say 4 personnel were also wounded in the exchange of fire. Friday, the Army reported airstrikes killing at least 30 fighters in the area adjacent to the Afghan border. The military launched the Waziristan offensive called Zarb-e-Azb in June and says it has so far cleared 90% territory of suspected terrorists. The operation area was later extended to nearby Khyber Agency, another tribal district on the Afghan border, to kill or capture militants fleeing from North Waziristan. A female member of Afghanistan's parliament has survived a suicide bombing that claimed the lives of at least 3 bystanders and wounded more than 10 others, including the lawmaker. Police say Shukriya Paragzai was traveling in a convoy through Kabul Sunday when the bomber detonated explosives. Authorities say Paragzai was slightly wounded in the attack but is in good condition. The women's rights advocate is a strong supporter of President Ashraf Ghani. The bombing in the Afghan capital was the latest attack on a member of the U.S.-backed Afghan government, which is fighting an insurgency led by the Taliban. Voting is underway in Japan's southernmost prefecture of Okinawa in a closely watched election for governor that could affect plans for the relocation of a U.S. air base there. The election is the first chance people of the island will get to send a message about incumbent Governor Hirokazu Nakayama's decision to allow landfill work in the city of Nago in preparation for the relocation of U.S. Marine Corps Futanma Air Station from the city of Ginawan. Governor Nakayama is running against 2 opponents who want the relocation canceled and a 3rd who wants to put the move to a referendum. Next week, the United Nations General Assembly is expected to vote on a resolution to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. VOA's Brian Patton reports that prior to proposing this action, the UN sent a letter to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un advising him that unless he took measures to improve repressive conditions in the country, he would be held accountable.
North Korea has tried a number of ways to either avoid or amend the UN resolution that would indict leader Kim Jong-un for crimes against humanity. The General Assembly resolution was drafted by the European Union and Japan and has more than 50 co-sponsors. United Nations human rights investigator Marsuki Darusmin documented a network of political prisons in North Korea holding 120,000 people and a list of atrocities that include extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions, and other sexual violence. Darusmin says he was invited to North Korea on the condition that he remove from the resolution any paragraphs that refer to the accountability of the North Korean leader.
Let me be very clear. Achieving accountability is paramount. The special rapporteur should be invited to visit DPRK without any preconditions and irrespective of the adoption of the resolution.
Daruzman says North Korea's recent decision to release two Americans who had been imprisoned there was an attempt to sway some votes in the UN. Cuba has sponsored an amendment that would remove the accountability-related paragraphs from the resolution. If the amendment makes it to a vote and gets a simple majority in the General Assembly, the resolution would be changed. But Daruzman says the UN offered the North Korean leader a way to avoid this diplomatic and legal battle. The UN directly sent Kim Jong-un a letter detailing the human rights violations and proposing measures that must be taken to end the repressive conditions.
We then requested that this be looked into by the Supreme Leader and that persons primarily responsible for these actions be taken into account.
By not taking action, he says the young leader of the country was warned that he would be held accountable for crimes and abuses that occurred in the past and that still continue today. North Korea also sent high-level officials to Russia Friday to lobby against the resolution, and its closest ally, China, has indicated it will consider vetoing the resolution in the UN Security Council, even if it passes the General Assembly.
That's Brian Patton reporting. More than a half million South Korean high school seniors took the university entrance exam this week. A high score is considered by many as the first step toward a successful life. However, reporter Jason Strother in Seoul tells us Korean school kids feel stressed out from all that pressure.
Parents wish their children good luck as they head into school to take the university entrance exam. Some younger high school students also came out to cheer on the test takers. 17-year-old Lee Ji-woo explains why the exam is so important.
This test can determine the rest of your life.
Lee is not exaggerating. South Korean high school students spend years studying for the test, and it is believed that a high score guarantees admission into a top university, a high-paying job, and even better marriage prospects down the road. But some observers say the way children are prepared to take the mostly multiple-choice test does not encourage students to think for themselves. And it is not only a problem in South Korean schools. Jasper Kim is a professor in the Division of International Studies at Seoul's Ewha Women's University.
By no means is South Korea an anomaly. I think you'll see similar things in China and to a lesser degree in Japan. It became the end-all be-all, the standardized tests, what you got on it. So what that created was a system of teaching to the test. So everyone was geared in terms of getting to the right answer, not knowing the right answer, and not knowing why that is the right answer.
Kim says this system of rote memorization produces a lot of stressed out students. And a recent government survey here found that compared to children from 29 other developed countries, South Korean kids are the unhappiest. Educational pressure is cited as the main reason why. President Park Geun-hye has pledged to reform her country's education system by encouraging more creative thinking and reducing student stress.
Jason Strother reporting on South Korea education. I'm Ira Melman. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on great radio stations around the world on VOA Global and as a podcast to which you may subscribe for free at voanews.com. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman, and this is our audience feedback section. We welcome your feedback, your ideas. Just send them, whatever you want to tell us, whether it's good, whether it's bad. Tell us on Facebook, Twitter, Weibo, and at VOA Asia at voanews.com. I cannot promise you that every comment you have will get on the air and get on this program. But if it's good, we pretty much will put it on for you. We are conducting a poll, and we are kind of polling everyone who's getting in touch with us to this question, the answer to this question. What do you think the APEC summit meetings have done to improve U.S.-China and China-Japan relations? Well, almost 13% of you said this will prompt long-term positive rains. Now, remember, that's only 13%. And over 40% said this won't fix anything. There is a potential for positive relations, but we have to wait and see. Nearly 42% said yeah, and 5% said they're unsure. And you can still vote on these questions at voanews.com/Asia. Now, we are giving something away. We're giving away our new 2015 VOA calendar. It features wonderful pictures of the American Southwest. All you have to do is write to us, however you want to write to us, at VOA Asia at voanews.com. Give us your mailing address in English and your own language, both, and we will send you a free copy. Keep in mind that these sometimes take a while to get to you. We are mailing them through the mail, but get in touch with us at that address. I think you'll enjoy the calendar. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. My name is Ira Melman. Coming up on the program, Michael Lippin will be here, and he has a look at the meeting that was widely reported last week in Beijing between the Chinese President Xi Jinping and the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, and it was described probably best as icy. Coming up.
This is VOA Global's weekly look at the Asian political scene. I'm Michael Lippin. Last week's meeting between Chinese President Xi Jinping and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Beijing was their first since the leaders of the two rival Asian powers took office in 2012. If you're wondering what took them so long, one major source of tension has involved a Tokyo war shrine that commemorates Japanese killed in wars with China and other powers. Among those honored at the Yasukuni Shrine are the souls of World War II-era Japanese leaders convicted of war crimes by an international tribunal. China and South Korea see Yasukuni as a symbol of Japan's wartime aggression against their nations and criticize any Japanese politicians who visit it. But that didn't stop Japan's Abe from making a visit to the shrine last December, his only one as prime minister. For more on why Japanese politicians continue to pay respects at Yasukuni, I spoke to Michael Green, Senior Vice President for Asia at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He told me that many officials go to the shrine to honor the souls of their relatives.
During the Second World War, when Japanese recruits went off to war, the last thing they would say to their families is, "I'll see you at Yasukuni." That if they died, that's where they would commune in the afterlife, where they'd be remembered by their family. So it's a very personal thing for a lot of Japanese families, including some very liberal scholars and politicians. It became controversial in a significant way in the 70s when 14 Class A war criminals were surreptitiously overnight by one of the priests enshrined in a Shinto ceremony. And so some politicians won't go for that reason, even if personally they want to go because of their own relatives. And other politicians do want to go for that reason, because there is a group in Japan that believes that the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal, which sentenced these 14 Class A war criminals, was victor's justice, that it was the Americans and the British and the Russians imposing a sentence because they won the war. And it's not a majority view, to be sure, but many conservative politicians say they should have the right to worship there because these war criminals weren't really war criminals. And that's the piece. That's the piece that's so controversial in China and Korea, in the United States even.
Now, some Japanese have been calling for years for the shrine's private owners to separate the 14 convicted war criminals enshrined at Yasukuni from the rest of the war dead. And one chapter of an influential conservative group called the War Bereaved Families Association, or Izokukai, expressed support for this idea too, for the first time just last month. How significant is that?
The Izokukai support for removing the 14 Class A war criminals is very significant politically, because it's the major group of survivors of the war dead. Of the 14 Class A war criminals, 13 direct descendants have said that they support this. And Prime Minister Tojo, his daughter opposed it, but now I think the Tojo family also is neutral. So politically, in terms of the family groups, including the 14 Class A war criminals' families, there's room to do this. The reason it hasn't happened is in part because there is no Shinto ritual to deshrine someone. It's, you know, they'd have to make it up. So many people say it wouldn't be legitimate. It still would be an issue. That's one argument. Another complication is that, as I mentioned earlier, those politicians, conservative politicians, who maintained that war criminals were not war criminals because this was a victor's standard imposed on a defeated Japan, they don't want to give on this issue. You know, my own personal view is that there's an opening here with what the Izokai said, and political leaders on the right in Japan should take advantage of it, because that would allow not only Japanese politicians, but also the emperor of Japan to finally resume worship at Yasukuni or visits to Yasukuni, which stopped when these 14 Class A war criminals were added. So that Izokai development is quite significant and encouraging.
That was Michael Green of the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. Join me again next week for more insights into the Asian political scene. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. China's role as APEC host last week allowed a rare opportunity for Beijing to showcase its vision for the global economy and the region. But as China's stature grows, so have tensions with other countries, including the United States. VOA's Bill Ide in Beijing reports on how China's rise as a global power is seen among Chinese and Americans.
For China, the APEC meetings were a carefully choreographed display of power and confidence. To ensure the colorful show went as planned, Beijing took serious steps. Factories shut down to clear the skies, and prominent Chinese activist Hu Jia, a critic of the government, says restrictions he faced under house arrest during APEC were worse than when he was in prison.
Xi Jinping has taken measures to safeguard stability in the hope that under the great temptation of its economy, no domestic and international activist will voice or mention the dark side of China's development.
Not all Chinese are as pessimistic about Beijing's rule. Indeed, many people here see the concerns expressed by China's neighbors about its expansive territorial claims as an inevitable reaction to Beijing's rise.
As China rises, that is perhaps putting more pressure on other countries, and those countries that want to suppress China.
China is not pursuing military expansion, but cooperation. Other countries shouldn't be so nervous. The world needs the support of several powerful economies, and as one of those countries, China has a responsibility to do its part.
In the U.S. capital, China's growing influence is on the minds of Americans as well. And for some, it's a source of concern.
In another 20 years, they'll own us like Japan used to, because they're buying up everything we have in this country.
We're so dependent on them. So I'm in banking, and most of our companies are having to outsource for the, you know, the things that we buy so cheap.
Given their monetary and political military wealth, I think it'll be a leader. So whether that's for good or not, I think it's to be determined.
These are still early days for China as an emergent global power. For its neighbors, Beijing's reputation will hinge more on its own actions than how the United States views it, says Asia analyst Bonnie Glaser.
Well, I would say that countries around China very much formulate their own judgments about China's intentions and areas where they should cooperate with China and where they shouldn't.
For now, China's neighbors are eager to sign new free trade deals, but they are also wary about China's expansive maritime territorial claims. And because of that, Beijing's image as either a benevolent rising economic power or authoritarian threat still hangs in the balance. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
However, the APEC summit had a negative impact on some nearby villages. The Associated Press reports that officials banned wood fires near the outskirts of Beijing in order to prevent the city's notorious pollution and to ensure blue skies. Villagers said traditional raised sleeping platforms are usually heated by coal, but that was not possible during the summit. While some gas systems were provided by authorities, not all village residents had access to them. During the Olympics in 2008, Chinese officials worked to clear Beijing's air quality to similarly make the city pleasant for international visitors. Beijing factories were also closed during the meeting to reduce the possibility of smog. In addition, government workers and schools were ordered to take a so-called APEC holiday during the summit to reduce traffic in the Chinese capital. However, those groups might have to show up for work or school on the weekends in order to make up for their lost time. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
On VOA Global from the Voice of America, I'm Ira Melman with Asia Business News. There is financial excitement in Hong Kong as Hong Kong stocks extended a five-day winning streak Friday as investors look ahead to the launch of the Hong Kong Shanghai Stock Connect program, and that is today, Monday. According to MarketWatch, the Stock Connect program, which will permit individual investors outside of China to buy Shanghai-listed shares for the first time ever, had been expected to start late last month, but it was delayed, with some blaming the wait on pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. The Hang Seng Index ended up 0.3% at 24,087, rising for a fifth consecutive day. For the week, the index posted a 2.3% gain, rather impressive. Among index heavyweights, Chinese online major Tencent climbed 1.9%, telecom giant China Mobile advancing 1.5%. However, brokerage firms pulled back after recent gains. China Galaxy Securities slid 5.5%, and Haitong Securities declined 1.5%. Hedge funds are scooping up shares of China's Alibaba Group holdings here in the United States in the third quarter, making the e-commerce giant one of the most commonly bought stocks among some of the biggest U.S. investors, that according to regulatory filings. Among the institutional investors that took new stakes in Alibaba were Soros Fund Management, Jana Partners, Janus Capital Management, Tiger Management, Moore Capital Management, Paulson & Company, Appaloosa Management, Third Point, and Omega Advisors. That's a look at Asia Business on the Voice of America on VOA Global. I'm Ira Melman. Have a good day.
This is Today in History. On November 17, 1558, the death of Queen Mary I of England ushered in the first Elizabethan age. The long reign of Mary's half-sister Elizabeth coincided with the advance of the English Renaissance. In 1603, English explorer and writer Sir Walter Raleigh went on trial for treason. Raleigh had been accused in a plot to remove King James I from the throne. On this day in 1869, the Suez Canal connecting the Mediterranean and the Red Seas was opened to navigation in an elaborate ceremony. On this day in 1973, in the midst of the Watergate scandal that eventually ended his presidency, President Richard Nixon made a now famous declaration during a televised question and answer session saying that he was not a crook. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Thanks for being with us on VOA Global from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson has the day off. You might remember last week we told you about a story that people were told to stay inside, outside of Paris, near Disneyland Paris. It has sparked a search that involves scores of police, soldiers, and helicopters because somebody said a tiger was on the loose and they couldn't figure out where this tiger was coming from. Well, authorities are now referring to the elusive animal not as a tiger, but as an unidentified feline, whatever that means. Creature was first spotted Thursday by a local woman in a parking lot, later seen crossing a highway. About a dozen troops were tapped to help scores of French police officers armed with tranquilizer guns hunt for it. But so far, they're not telling us what this thing is. Is it a monster or not? Steve Norman is up next.
And now, VOA's International Edition. More beheadings by the Islamic State, tensions between President Obama and Vladimir Putin, plus we'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Islamic State militants are claiming they have beheaded U.S. hostage Abdulrahman Qasig. President Obama said the aid worker was killed in an act of pure evil. New video posted online does not show Qasig's beheading, but it does show the militants beheading at least 14 men, which they say were pilots and officers loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. With Qasig's death, the Islamic State terrorists have now beheaded five Westerners it was holding. Also in the news, the G20 summit in Brisbane, Australia has ended, capping a week of summits that saw several awkward encounters between U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian leader Vladimir Putin. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with Mr. Obama and has this report from Brisbane.
Australia, the host of this year's G20, wanted this meeting to focus on trade and job growth, but it was President Obama's efforts to isolate Vladimir Putin on the sidelines that got center stage at the summit. During the meeting in Brisbane, the two leaders saw each other on a number of occasions. Following the conclusion of the summit, Mr. Obama reviewed the encounters.
I would characterize them as typical of our interactions, which are businesslike and blunt. And my communications to him was no different than what I've said publicly, as well as what I've said to him privately over the course of this crisis in Ukraine. And that is, Russia has the opportunity to take a different path.
The tensions between the two men were obvious before both leaders came to Brisbane. At the APEC summit in Beijing last week, the two men often appeared to look in each other's direction, but not at each other. White House aides later confirmed there had been a series of informal conversations in which Mr. Obama confronted Mr. Putin on Ukraine and called on Russia to abide by a September ceasefire agreement. Photos of one meeting showed the two men focused on each other, neither of them smiling. As evidence mounted that Russian equipment and troops were crossing the border into Ukraine, President Putin appeared to be going on a charm offensive at public gatherings in Beijing. On opening night of the APEC summit, the recently divorced Russian leader was caught on camera putting a shawl on the wife of Chinese President Xi Jinping. Her aides promptly removed the shawl and replaced it with one of her own garments. The scene triggered a slew of critical comments on Chinese social media, with some bloggers calling Mr. Putin's gesture improper and demonstrating poor taste. Similarly, as a side note, President Obama was criticized for chewing gum at public events in Beijing. Things did not get better for President Putin later in the week in Australia, where Mr. Obama did not waste the chance to isolate the Russian leader. The U.S. president called a trilateral meeting with allies Australia and Japan, and they issued a statement making clear their opposition to Russia's annexation of Crimea, its actions to destabilize eastern Ukraine, and calling for those responsible for the downing of Malaysia Flight 17 to be brought to justice. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Brisbane.
Hardest hit of the West African nations facing the Ebola outbreak, Liberia has set a national goal of recording no new cases by December 25th. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf made that announcement in a Sunday radio address. More than 2,800 Ebola deaths have been recorded in Liberia so far. UN Children's Fund says it will open 10 new Ebola community care centers this week in Sierra Leone's Bombali district, one of the hardest hit areas by the fatal disease. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the UN in Geneva.
Latest UN figures show Sierra Leone is approaching 5,600 Ebola cases, including nearly 1,200 deaths. Among the reasons for these numbers is the failure of people infected with Ebola to go to treatment centers, which often are far away from where they live. People who remain at home are at risk of infecting family members and surrounding communities. To try to remedy this, the UN Children's Fund is introducing community care centers, a concept developed by the World Health Organization. The agency is opening the first of 10 such centers in Bombali District in northern Sierra Leone, with plans to build around 30 more centers in neighboring districts in the coming weeks. UNICEF representative in Sierra Leone, Roland Monash, speaking from Freetown, says the focus of these centers is to isolate all Ebola cases, to avoid infecting others, and to provide infected people with safe care in the community. The centers will be run by the government of Sierra Leone through its district health management team with the participation of local non-governmental organizations. Monash tells VOA the main health workers in these clinics are trained nurses who come from the communities themselves.
The family members are indeed allowed to see their loved ones which are affected from a protected and safe distance. We are setting them up in the communities because often people have to wait very long before they're moved out of their households to treatment centers far away. And while they're at home, they are being affecting others. Secondly, there are not enough beds in the other places as well, so the community care centers also provide additional beds for treatment as such.
Monash says UNICEF has worked closely with local authorities and traditional leaders to make sure these centers are accepted and become an integral part of the communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has announced a new effort focused on keeping and extending American military superiority. VOA's Carla Babb reports.
The new Defense Innovation Initiative is a push for breakthroughs in cutting-edge technology, from robotics to big data and even three-dimension printing. Secretary Hagel talked about the initiative at the Reagan National Defense Forum, where he warned the Pentagon's technological advantage was eroding.
While we spent over a decade focused on grinding stability operations, countries like Russia and China have been heavily investing in military modernization programs to blunt our military's technological edge.
Hagel said financial management will be critical to change. He called on Congress to provide the military with an actual budget rather than passing temporary funding bills. He warned sequestration could cause $1 trillion in cuts over the next decade. And he also warned of a potential budget hole of more than $70 billion over the next 5 years if Congress does not stop blocking the Pentagon's money-saving proposals, from retiring old aircraft to closing bases. Carla Babb, VOA News, Simi Valley, California.
One last item, the European Space Agency on Sunday unveiled images of that probe of theirs bouncing while it was making a historic landing on a comet last week. Science lab laden with 10 instruments, the probe went down, was sent down to the comet from its mothership after a 10-year trek that covered 6.5 billion kilometers around the inner solar system. Although so some of the stories making news this hour, you can find a lot more at our website right here, voanews.com.
From VOA Global in Washington, I'm Ira Melman with a look at business news. The Eurozone economy grew more strongly than expected in the third quarter as France beat market forecast and Germany narrowly avoided a recession, but the bloc remains weak and could need further stimulus. Eurostat, the European Union Statistics Office, said Friday that the 18 countries sharing the euro expanded 0.2% in July and September compared with the previous 3 months when they grew 0.1%. So year-to-year, Eurozone growth was 0.8% in the third quarter, the same as in April and June. Eurostat also confirmed its earlier estimate that Eurozone inflation stood at only 0.4% last month. The death of a pregnant woman and her unborn baby in a car crash in Malaysia involving a faulty airbag has led to another U.S. recall. Ford Motor Company agreed to recall more 2004 and 2005 Ranger small pickup trucks after the crash in Malaysia because their airbags are similar to the one that caused the deaths in a Honda vehicle. That according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration outside Washington. More than 12 million vehicles have been recalled worldwide because of a potentially deadly problem with airbag inflators made by Japanese auto parts supplier Takata. At least 5 deaths and multiple injuries have been linked to the problem, which occurs when airbags inflate with too much force and blow apart metal canisters in which they're contained, sending shrapnel into the passenger compartment. Facebook is telling marketers to stop putting up posts that look like advertisements unless they actually are paid promotions. Social network said in a blog the post started last year. Users' news feeds will show fewer posts and prompt readers to buy a product. That's a look at business news. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. My name is Ira Melman. My partner here, Jim Stevenson, has this day off. So stay with us here on VOA Global. Coming up will be my feature of American Cafe. I think you'll enjoy it. It deals with how journalists are being trained differently now in the United States than they had. Also, a feature on a new documentary about Muhammad Ali. Stay with us. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. The internet and rapidly evolving technology is quickly changing how people receive news and how journalists deliver it. One school in Los Angeles is teaching the next generation of journalists with the help of state-of-the-art newsrooms. Elizabeth Lee has more.
Unlike their counterparts of past generations, students at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Journalism learn to deliver news across all platforms, including television, radio, and the web. And that's not all, says Willow Bay, director of the School of Journalism.
But today, we expect journalists to be able to use all sorts of technological tools to research stories, to vet that research, to analyze that research. We expect them to be fluid in multimedia storytelling skills. We expect them increasingly to be their own marketing and distribution arms, to get their stories in front of audiences and to spread those stories as far as they can.
They also have to be tech savvy, and that means learning basic computer programming languages. But with new technology, future journalists should tread carefully, says the Media Center's executive director, Serena Cha.
In the journalism arena, we've got to consider carefully, how do we teach students to use the tools responsibly? So, yes, new technology often raises new questions because you're able to manipulate reality even more than before.
Faculty members say at the core of all this technology, students still need to learn traditional journalism, how to write and tell a compelling story in a way that is accurate, fair, and balanced. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
I Am Ali, a documentary by Claire Lewis, offers an intimate portrait of boxing legend Muhammad Ali through anecdotal audio tapes he recorded with family and friends by the end of his career. VOA's Penelope Pulu is in the cafe with that story.
My father has a lot of sides, and you hear about the fights. You don't hear about family that much and what that meant to him.
What's your dad's name?
Muhammad Ali.
No one, not even some members of his family, knew of the existence of these audio tapes until recently.
Mom? You're now 11 years old.
They thread the narrative of the boxing champion's life in Claire Lewis's documentary. Ali's daughter, Hannah, offered the tapes to Lewis.
See, I love my daddy.
I love my daddy.
I love my poo-poo head daddy.
Okay.
My father was always conscious about history. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why he made this series of audio tape cassette recordings.
Say, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
The film shows the whole world in love with him. Testimonials of friends and adversaries paint the Olympian and three-time boxing champion, Cassius Clay, later Muslim convert Muhammad Ali, as a sensitive, poignant, and courageous man. Because he refused to serve in the Vietnam War, he was stripped of his championship title, and his boxing license was revoked. But he stuck to his convictions, and in 1974, at the age of 32, Ali made a comeback.
When George Foreman meets me, he'll pay his debt. I can drown a drink of water and kill a dead tree. Wait till you see Muhammad Ali.
He defeated formidable George Foreman and recaptured his title. Ali has aged. We hear him begin to slur his words, a sign of developing Parkinson's disease. He finally retired in the late 1970s, and in the mid-80s, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But to the world and his children, he remains an icon of power and grace. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You can hear American Cafe every day on air and online at voanews.com as well as a podcast. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe.
Hi, everyone. This is David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Impressionist artist Edgar Degas' famous statue, Little Dancer Aged 14, is the subject of a new musical here in Washington at the Kennedy Center. The statue, one of Degas' last works before he lost his sight, caused a commotion when it was first exhibited in Paris in 1881. The artist sculptured the statue out of wax, gave it real human hair and a real tutu and slippers. But it has also become one of his most famous works. Allison Lukes is the acting head of sculpture and decorative arts at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. She told the Associated Press that visitors there have a unique chance to see the original statue.
The statuette is the only work of sculpture that Degas ever exhibited in his whole lifetime. And it's also the original version of a very famous statuette, famous because after Degas' death, it was replicated at his family's wishes in beautiful bronze casts, more than 30 of them. And those can be seen in museums all over the world today and in private collections. But the original, the only one Degas ever touched or saw, is the one that's here in this room.
The actual dancer portrayed was Marie van Gutham, a Belgian-born girl trying to make it in the Paris Opera in the late 1800s. Allison Lukes says that the statuette offers viewers a glimpse of a young girl on the verge of womanhood who is determined to succeed.
We see her at the age of 14, and Degas carefully included her age in the title of the sculpture. He didn't give his paintings and drawings and sculptures titles at all. This one, it really mattered to him to tell you that she was 14, meaning that she was at the beginning. She was on the brink. She could go either way.
The $7 million Kennedy Center musical looks at Marie and Degas' relationship during this time. Parts of the musical story are based on writings left by the artist and American artist Mary Cassatt, who collaborated with Degas in Paris. Susan Stroman is the show's choreographer and director.
She came from a very poor family, but wanted to become a ballerina. And Degas really sort of became obsessed drawing her and painting her. You see her face in many of his pictures and paintings. So it was really, the idea was to bring her back to life.
Stroman is known for her works on the Broadway productions of Contact, The Music Man, and The Producers. New York City Ballet principal dancer Tyler Peck plays Marie. Peck told the AP that she believes that Marie was a match for the artist in every respect.
I just feel like they love to bicker, Degas and Marie. You know, they're like, he's finally met a ballerina who isn't afraid to speak. And I think that that's what's really special about her, is that she's not scared of him and she's not afraid to speak her mind, when normally ballerinas, you know, you don't think they speak.
Marie van Gutham was dismissed from the Paris Opera in 1882, and she disappeared from the historical records. The show hints at several paths that her life could have taken. Susan Stroman says that the musical also shows the difficulties that women faced in the French capital in the late 1800s.
It's a serious story because it does touch on the plight of women in Paris in 1881 and what their options were. So it does have a very serious tone to it. Yet within that, it has the joy of dance.
The musical is a unique combination. It's about a statue that was inspired by the ballet. Multiple Tony Award winner Boyd Gaines plays Degas. The musical Little Dancer plays at Washington's Kennedy Center through November. The statuette, Little Dancer Aged 14, remains on display at Washington's National Gallery of Art. So, what do you think? Are you a fan of the Impressionists? Have you ever seen Little Dancer Aged 14? Do you have a favorite sculpture or painting by Edgar Degas or another artist? Let us know your thoughts and ask your questions on our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email us your thoughts by addressing them to voaasia@voanews.com. That's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
You are listening to VOA Global from the Voice of America in Washington. I'm Ira Melman. Jim Stevenson has the day off today. Story I just saw just before coming on the air here. A guy by the name of Dale Hopfinger ran into a problem. He was trying to vote in Michigan a week or so ago, but he told he was dead. Well, they made up for it. They went and they searched the records and they finally let him vote. But what a surprise. From the Voice of America, here's a look at sports. Roger Federer pulled out of the ATP Finals less than an hour before his title match against Novak Djokovic, Sunday, handing a third straight title to this event to the top-ranked Serb and dealing a potential blow to Switzerland Davis Club ambitions. The 17-time Grand Slam champion said he hurt his back in the nearly three-hour semifinal win over Davis Cup teammate Stan Wawrinka Saturday night, in which Federer saved four match points. With Federer sidelined, Djokovic was awarded the Tour Finals title for the third successive year, making him the first player to achieve that feat since Yvon Lendl did it in the 1980s. Federer appeared at center court to apologize to fans who had been streaming in to the 17,500-seat London Arena, and then he spoke with an ATP interviewer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very disappointing end to the season. You know, I was playing so well here, had a great season so far, and I was feeling great, you know, until yesterday's tiebreaker. I felt all of a sudden my back was playing funny, and then... you know, I tried to have treatment on it, medication on it. I just tried to turn around as quick as possible, really. But didn't feel that much of an improvement overnight. And then, as you know, I don't have a day off or anything to work with. Obviously, it's not enough time to recover. And the way I feel right now, there's no way I can compete, you know, at any level, really. So probably in a few days it's going to be better, but. Right now, it's not good enough, and so clearly it's very disappointing. But nevertheless, you know, congratulations to Novak. That's how it goes. You got to put yourself in those positions. He's done that again, and congrats on world number one as well. He's had a terrific season.
Djokovic agreed to play an exhibition match against Andy Murray in a bid to at least partially satisfy the disappointed crowd. American Brooke Koepka beat out Englishman Ian Poulter in the Turkish Airlines Open golf competition.
I mean, so much. I can't really put it into words right now, but it's special. I've been waiting for this for a long time, and it's nice, especially to happen here.
It is Koepka's first European title, and there you have it, a look at sports from the Voice of America. Now a look at this week in history. On November 12, 1991, the now independent nation of East Timor was struggling to end its occupation by Indonesia. An event occurred on that day that is considered a turning point in its independence movement. The day is remembered for the mass shooting of demonstrators by Indonesian troops known as the Santa Cruz Massacre. This massacre followed the upsurge in protests that erupted following the cancellation of a United Nations observer mission. An event that dashed hopes that the international community might have attention to the situation in East Timor. VOA's Dave DeForest talked with Connecticut University professor Brad Simpson about the events surrounding this massacre.
The Indonesian general in command at the time, General Tri Sutrisno, was going around the territory and warning various communities that if there was any protest, any organized opposition, that there would be a bloodbath. And he let the Timorese know that they were building mass graves on the outskirts of Dili and said in no uncertain terms that any attempt to contact this international observer mission would be met with great repression. But the Timorese, feeling that they had little to lose, were nevertheless going forward with this planned protest. And when the mission was canceled, there was a group of Timorese students who recognized that they were vulnerable and open to arrest and possible torture by Indonesian authorities. And so a number of the organizers of the planned protest took shelter in the main Catholic church in the capital city of Dili. And one of the young organizers, a young man named Sebastio Gomez, was dragged out of the church by Indonesian soldiers who raided the church on the night of November 10th, and he was executed on the steps of the church. And so many Timorese felt that they had nothing to lose anymore once the sanctity of the main Catholic church in the capital city had been violated. And so on November 12th, 1991, the Timorese decided to hold a memorial procession for Sebastio Gomez from the steps of the Catholic church in Dili to the cemetery on the outskirts of town, known as the Santa Cruz Cemetery. And this was the immediate context leading up to the massacre that took place on November 12th.
How did the security services justify opening fire on a crowd of people who were really there for a memorial procession? I know it became a demonstration, but there wasn't any violence. How did they justify opening fire on a crowd of civilians?
Well, the logic of the Indonesian Armed Forces was best stated by General Sutrisno, who said that these people were troublemakers and they must be shot and we will shoot them. And the memorial procession actually started out fairly small. Was a couple of hundred people gathered at the church who began marching, bearing crosses and some signs, marching on the way out of town up to the church. But as they began marching, people began to pour out of their homes, out of offices, out of other buildings in town, until there were perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 people marching through the streets of Dili on the way to the Catholic church. Troops who were lining the streets saw this as a pretty grave challenge to their authority. So the Timorese marched their way up the main road to the Santa Cruz Cemetery. When Indonesian troops began to march up the road behind them, hundreds of Indonesian troops, maybe a dozen abreast, holding the rifles at the ready, and they had cut off the Timorese from their only escape route. And the Indonesian troops simply marched up the road. The first line of troops knelt down, held their rifles out, and simply opened fire on the crowd, and they began just mowing people down with their M16 rifles, and row upon row of Indonesians would sweep forward, firing into the crowd. The Timorese tried to go through the cemetery and escape. They were piling up in the entrance of the cemetery, dozens of bodies. Others were scrambling over the cemetery wall and scrambling over the pile of bodies to try and get to the cemetery to escape. And the Indonesian troops, once they had finished massacring those who were standing in front of the cemetery, began to systematically work their way through the cemetery, killing survivors, throwing bodies onto trucks that they took out of town to bury in mass graves. And in the days after, it later became known, Indonesian soldiers and intelligence officers went around systematically hunting for survivors in hospitals and homes and killed several scores more. And so no one knows exactly how many people died, but the best estimates are somewhere between 350 and 400 people were killed either on November 12th or in the immediate aftermath.
That is Brad Simpson. He is an associate professor of history and Asian studies at the University of Connecticut. He is also the director of the Indonesia and the East Timor Documentation Project at the National Security Archives. This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Story I just found, another one here, and it is now the law in North Korea that every male, has to get a haircut that resembles their leader, Kim Jong-un. Well, this new haircut restriction called the Dear Leader Kim Jong-un was implemented a little over a month ago. Experts say they have yet to see the effect of it, and you just have to wonder if they have bought a lot of buckets so the barbers can sculpt whatever they have to do. Another story, a Japanese pet company is opening a nursing home for elderly dogs, providing round-the-clock veterinary care. A specialist gym also has a swimming pool in it. Aeon Pet Company, that's Aeon Pet Company, a subsidiary of the Aeon supermarket chain in Japan, has opened the first dog retirement home. It's at a shopping mall east of Tokyo, providing an initial intake of 20 dogs with full-time care. The Nanano Ushi, a spokeswoman for the company, said told the Telegraph newspaper, "We decided to open the nursing facility because so many dog owners have requested something like this." Says many Japanese people have pets now, but of course they get old. It can be difficult to care for them. And again, from Japan, a dog retirement home. That's going to wrap things up for us here on VOA Global on this day. Our thanks to Tracy Carter. He is our director. Our technical director is Carl Starling. And the boss is Diane Gal. Have yourself a wonderful day.